Welcome. Here's, I have a whole lot I want to do. I guess I could tell you a little bit more about me. I'm the Missionary Resources Director for GCM. So I live in Orlando, Florida right now, and sort of oversee the staff program for GCM. So if you come on staff with any of the campus churches and you raise support, you've probably come and seen me or seen our team. And I teach the trainings and how to raise funds, but sort of oversee everything from recruiting to how we hire to fundraising to how health benefits work, a lot of stuff. So it's a weird job for me because I actually was I'm in an office now and go sort of 8:30 to 5:30, but I was a campus staff member at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, for a long time, and that's where I went to undergrad. And then I was a Microsoft consultant and then went on staff in 2000 originally, then 2001. And so sort of been around GCM since like 1995. A little of my story, just so you know, like, because, you know, people usually want to know who's that guy that's talking at us. I grew up in a military family. We moved around all over the place. My dad was in nuclear submarines. He was not there when I was born. He was off the coast of He Won't Tell Us, Soviet nation. And when he came back, my mom had become a Christian. Random. There was navigators there at the military base in South Carolina who like were all about sharing the gospel and mentoring people, and they found her, and she was a lonely mom that was about to have a baby, and they shared the gospel. She became a Christian. My dad came home, and he had to become a Christian because there we were, babying Jesus, you know. And so I got raised in a new Christian home where we moved around all over the world, and we lived in, like, you know, the Middle East and Guam, and I did most of high school in Japan. And then returned back to Chicago, which is the family hometown. And I wound up at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, there for undergrad. When I went to college, my whole goal was to ditch the Christianity I learned growing up. Because my dad, what he had done is he was in submarines, but at some point he said, man, I like this so much, I'm going to get out of the military, go to seminary, and get back in the military and be a chaplain. And so I grew up actually as a pastor's kid in the military, listening to my dad preach, sort of being a missionary kid, military kid, pastor's kid at once. And so I faked things really well, sitting in the second row and smiling at my dad's sermon, being a youth group leader kind of person, playing musical kind of things. But my dad and I fought a ton. My family had a lot of, I felt, hypocrisy in it. We'd come to be the ministry family, go home, and it'd be awful. And it was painful stuff. And so when I went to U of I, I said, screw this. I am so excited about not doing Jesus. There's got to be other stuff. There was a test online called the Purity Test. This was online was new to us when we went to college. I was like, oh, cool, the internets. We sort of had AOL, not really, if you've heard of AOL, right? There was a list of like 100 things you could do, sex, drugs, drinking, that if you did these things, you'd be less pure. I originally took this little test online, and I was like, I'm like 97% pure, and I don't want to be. So I used this as a checklist of trying things out. So I was sleeping around and drinking a whole lot. I did sometimes go. There was a GCM staff member who I hated. His name was Jim Johnson. And he would call a lot my dorm room, Forbes Hall, and the six-pack at the University of Illinois. I lived on the second floor, and I'd come home all the time. This was pre-cell phones, and this was all about answering machines, right, with the tape, you know, beep, you know, and be like, hey, Chris, it's Jim. We met like a few weeks ago, and it was so great to meet you. We have a small group in your dorm. Would love for you to come, you know, like, delete, you know, like, beep, hi, hey, Chris, it's Jim. I'm at your dorm downstairs. Like, weirdo, you know, and so 6 messages later, you know, so I'd go to this sometimes so I could tell my mom, who they had moved immediately away from Illinois, 2,000 miles away again, that I was going to a Christian thing while I really wasn't, was barely. But, you know, that life, my freshman year, I ran it into the wall because I was in charge and almost wrecked it, became seriously depressed, wasn't attending any classes because I was out drinking late at night, and I went on a mission trip to Mexico with my church. We were going to drive to my church. It wasn't my church at the time, but we were going to drive 20 hours down to Mexico. They were going to build houses. I could not find a cooler thing to do, so I said, I guess I will go fake it to be with the Christian kids because I know how to do that for the week. And I went with this crew, and it turns out all these people are sort of nicer than I thought. Like, they weren't as nerdy as I thought Christians were. And I found myself praying in Mexico for the first time in many years. And I returned to school depressed out of my mind, and I remember a specific Thursday afternoon where I was sort of locked in my fourth floor dorm room, like really, I don't know if you do this, I had been up all night trying to finish homework that I didn't understand. I was an engineer. Mm-hmm. I had relationships that were falling apart. I was in this group of friends that decided we were going to do friends with benefits and sleep around. A lot of jealousy, a lot of relationships of fraction broke it up, maybe because sex has something to do with bonding, and we were completely screwing that up. And so I felt lonely, confused, and I was trapped in my room with my knees against my chest, crying, just waiting for someone to rescue me. And so I called Wayne Wager. He's the guy I met on the missions trip, and I said, I don't really know you very well, but I really need help. And he took me to a coffee shop in Champaign and bought me coffee, and I just felt safe to pour out my guts to him. My vision of a pastor was someone that was supposed to open a Bible and point out where you sinned. He stood up and gave me a hug. Didn't think I wanted that. It's really what I needed. And he said, do you want to change your whole life? I said, yeah, what I've been doing is not working. And so that was the start of me understanding. I knew the Westminster Catechism when I was 7. That's an awkward fact when your dad was a Presbyterian minister. I don't know if I understood grace until I sat in a coffee shop with Wayne. It changed my life. That's how I sort of got involved with the church, learned to lead a small group there, apprenticed under people to lead a small group, became a small group leader, wound up becoming a coach of small groups later on, going on staff, and then being the director of our small groups at our church for a long time. And so, by God's grace, all that. So some of the stuff we're going to do today is just from the experience that I learned in our church, and then I've also helped direct some LT programs, some Colorado LT programs, and so some of this is from the way we do leadership there. Anyway, that's a little my story. Hopefully that's helpful to you to sort of know where I'm coming from. Where should we go? Here's what I'm hoping, even though it's like 2:15 already. I was hoping to do 20 to 30 minutes on what I have. That might be optimistic. We'll see. And then I was hoping maybe one or two of us, maybe even three of us, have a question about your leadership situation, and we can try to talk it out a little bit. So that's what we'll try for. If you're ready, let's just start with the classic, 2 Timothy 2. If you have a Bible, if you don't, that's fine. Actually, 2 Timothy 2:1, some people might have it memorized. Some churches would memorize it. Does anyone have that memorized? It's fine if not. Let's get someone to read it that gets it.
2:1.
Yeah. 2:1 and 2, I'm sorry. I should have both. Who wants it? Julie Wesley. Oh, you, yeah.
Do you want to read it?
Sure.
Timothy,
yeah, 1 and 2, you're right.
Timothy, my dear son, be strong through the grace that God gives you in Christ Jesus. You have heard me teach things that have been confirmed by many reliable witnesses. Now teach these truths to other trustworthy people who will be able to pass them on to others.
Who here is leading a group? Like, almost all of us. Okay, great. Well, that didn't leave a whole lot of us, but who's apprenticing to lead a group or just learning to lead? Sort of have some, anyone know?
A little bit?
Okay. Is anyone coaching groups, like you're coaching? Yeah, sort of, okay. Is anyone a coach's coach? If you don't, yeah, okay, a little bit, working with coaches. Good, yeah. This is 2 Timothy 2:1 and 2, right? And let's just start with the basics on this. Who's this from and to? It's from?
Paul.
Paul, yes. Who's it to?
Timothy.
Timothy, right? This is sort of a mentor relationship, right? Now, Paul's not there. Paul's writing to Timothy. Does anyone know where Timothy is? Where he is? He's in a city. He's in Ephesus. And he's sort of working with this church. And this is sort of written right at the end of Paul's life, probably. I should say this, because I'm a seminary nerd. Some people, if you take a religious studies class at university, they might tell you, hey, 2 Timothy was written actually in about 100 years after Paul was alive, and there's some theories about that, but just so you know that. But we're going to say this is written at the end of Paul's life. And the reason why it's complicated is it's hard to tell sometimes with 2,000-year-old documents. It's hard to date. It doesn't say at the top. There's no time and date stamp like a file on this thing, so you have to figure it out. But I think this is definitely written from Paul to Timothy, and it's written in 67. And he's sort of in this situation where Timothy has been working with his church. He sent him there to do this. And he says this amazing thing. Hey, you then, my child, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And what you have heard from me through many witnesses, entrust to faithful people who will be able to teach others as well. Yours might say, you then, my son, instruct a faithful men. But really, it is my child. It's technon. So it's really my dear one. And trust a faithful people, anthropi, so it's male or female. But and so you have this chain, and I'm sure you probably have had this taught a little bit in your church, where you have these four people, and I have a tale. Good. Of Paul, right? Teaching Timothy. But he tells Timothy to talk to faithful people, right? Who will pass on to others also. Apparently their name is also. Others also. And so you have this sort of chain, right, in one verse of four levels. Paul teaching Timothy, who's teaching faithful people, who's teaching others also. I asked, hey, who is being an apprentice in a small group? Who is leading a small group? Who's being a coach in a small group? And who might be a coach's coach? And I can sort of see four layers on the same four layers. What if these are apprentices? These are small group leaders. Timothy is a small group coach, and Paul is a small group's coach. There's this idea of passing things on. The word apprentice, just to start with, I'm using that word already, but do you use that in your church? Do people, yes, sort of. Someone that's learning how to lead a group and in the group and working with that. But these are the sort of four levels. And for me, as I was starting to learn this, I realized when I was first leading a small group, I was a sophomore. I was in the end of my sophomore year in junior. And I was in the six-pack dorm, again, that same dorm that I was in before. It's called the six-pack because there's six dorms there. But mostly it's called the six-pack because of the amount of beer that flows through the place. But and I was in the small group, and I was an apprentice. Gavin Hab asked me to be an apprentice. Gavin was on staff with GCM. And he said, hey, you want to be my apprentice for my small group? We met on Wednesday nights, and we met in the basement. And he'd show up and sort of lead it, and I was supposed to watch him for a while. You know, this is the first time I did this. But he said, hey, by the way, someone's sort of mentoring me. His name is Matt Wachowski. And I was like, oh, cool, Matt Wachowski. He was sort of our, he was another staff guy, and now a pastor at University of Illinois. And Matt Wachowski, someone was mentoring him, and it was actually Greg Veneta at the time, directly. And so I was like, this is sort of cool. I actually realized that I can, Gavin to Matt to Greg Veneta, who's practically Jesus, I can, like, I've got all four levels right here as well, you know? And so I was like, this is really interesting the way this group does this. They sort of seem to pass down from person to person how you do things. Well, this is a fascinating model for me. And so I was just in it sort of at the others thing, and now I find that I get to coach coaches a lot. And so for whether it was me with Gavin, Matt, and Greg, or Paul and Timothy, or us in our situation, I want to sort of examine all four levels and how they work, if that makes sense. My definition of leadership, and this is one that's real common, John Maxwell sort of is one of the originators, is leadership is influence. Yeah, right? Have you heard this one? Leadership is influence. Because influence is something that changes people or things. I think this would be Jesus' definition as well if he wrote a self-help book on management. But leadership is influence. It's really change. How am I going to influence? Leadership is not particularly authority, position, or station. It's influence. And so I can lead from above, beside, or below. In fact, when I evaluate staff or manage them, when we talk about staff, I don't know if you know this, they have an evaluation sort of thing they do each year to see how it's going. And one of the things we talk about, I mean, there's things like humility and how good are you at leading small groups, and there's one thing on leadership. And every time I evaluate a staff member, we say, how are you leading above? How are you leading beside? How are you leading below? And how are you leading yourself? So four axes. And they... below is what people normally think. The people say, I have someone that's following me. How are they leading them? Great. But I want to know also, how are they influencing their peers, the people that sort of are beside them? How are they influencing the people above them? Because leadership actually can go that direction too. And so I have 11 staff that work for me in the office at GCM, and I ask them, how are you leading me? Like, how when we have a problem, when you need to walk into the office and that kind of stuff, I need you to, like, in your giftedness and your abilities to come in, and like, I might be my decision at the end of the day, but you are influencing me to take a course of action. How are you leading me? And so we lead in all directions, and that's why I like the influence definition. This model of leadership, and this might seem real intuitive to you because the campus churches do this stuff really well. But I don't know if you've been in other ministry situations. They don't think like this as much. A lot of times you'll see leadership taught in a teaching way. So you're going to sit in a classroom just like this and listen, and then you're going to learn from the teacher, and then you're going to go do it. But most of us think about leadership, and if we think about leadership as influence, we talk about teaching someone else how to do something as a modeling sort of way. So not teaching, but modeling. So we watch somebody else do something, right? And then we try to do it after them. Gosh, it's way more real life because they're sort of doing it, and we're trying to sort of imitate and look at what they are doing. So everything I do from now on has to do with modeling. One of the advantages of modeling is just seeing. And I sort of think Matt Wachowski and I are real good friends. And I don't know if he's a pastor at University of Illinois. And when I was young, 18 and 19, him and his wife Lisa were an influential family on me. And they started right away when I was starting to lead that small group as a junior, getting me involved with their family. And one of the ways they did it, and a lot of these families do this, say, hey, do you want to babysit? And I said, I guess so, I don't know. And they'd pick me up after class and drive me back to their house, and I'd sort of sit in the living room while their kids were sort of asleep. But they'd wake up, and I'd get to spend a little bit of time with their family, and then they'd drive me back to class. I told you that I grew up in a house where me and my dad fought a lot, and we didn't have good dynamics. Matt, when he was getting up, his small sons, they'd get up and they'd be sort of crying and sort of, you know, how kids wake up from a nap, sort of, you know. And he'd be so patient, and he'd talk with them. And one thing that Matt did all the time was sort of get down on one knee when he talked to his kids to look them in the eye. Have you seen parents do that? That never happened in my house, but he was trying to be on the same level as his kids. Just so they could have a conversation that was sort of peer-to-peer, and they didn't feel dominated by him. And he never said one word to me about him doing that, but I'd watch him do it all the time on Tuesday afternoons when I'd babysit at their house. That modeling, just me seeing that, affected how I thought about what it meant to be a leader and who he was as a person. And so his modeling was much more effective than if he had sat in a classroom and sort of said, okay, be sure not to talk down to people. I had watched it happen, but he's never said those words. And so I think modeling is the way we want to think about how do we influence people and train them. I'm talking at you, but is it making sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me do real classic, what, who, and how. So sort of basic, I guess, but what do we pass on as Christian leaders? And there's three words that you might hear used a lot, either this or a variation in your church, but I'll suggest these three. These are hardly original to me. Doctrine, skill, and character. Three areas of Christian maturity in doctrine or knowledge. Skill, like ministry skills, and character, Christian character, Christian virtue. Who's familiar? Have you heard this before, these three things? Some, yes. These are actually some of the core ideas that even in GCM churches, when we talk about, hey, who's qualified to be a deacon or an elder, these three areas are looked at. But these go all the way down to someone like an apprentice in a small group, right? Like, what do we know about God, and what truth do we know? How good are we at what we're doing in terms of skill and the skills of reaching out, relationally leading, and then our character? Who are we when no one is around? Integrity, you know, faithfulness, love, these kind of things. When we train in all three of these areas, each one of them has a different relationship, sort of, connected with them. So the doctrine sort of thing, and I'll just say all sort of groups and churches tend to have strengths and weaknesses. I would say that GC campus churches are probably best at character. I just really think we are. We're really good at emphasizing that this is important, you know. I would think we're least good at doctrine. I mean, we do all these, but we're less good at some of the harder sort of Bible truth kind of stuff. And I think we're in the middle, I think, on the skill stuff, and we do both good and bad there. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church in America after my dad got ordained, and that's a Presbyterian conservative denomination in the U.S. that's very good at probably doctrine. They have a lot of theologians and seminaries, and they talk, a lot of their sermons sound a little bit like a seminary lecture. They might have five-point outlines and use words like infralapsarianism, which is a word I knew when I was 12, which is child abuse, let's be clear. they were good at this, but probably less good at these things. And so I actually feel real blessed that our church is actually very strong in this character area, and we can learn the other stuff. But the three relationships, doctrine, I think, is a student-teacher relationship. Right, so I got to teach some knowledge and this kind of thing. And so you have this, we even use the word, Paul in Ephesians 4 even uses the word teacher to talk about someone that has it in the sort of five-fold model of leadership of evangelist, pastor, teacher, apostle, and prophet. The teacher sort of has this ability to teach and learn and impart knowledge and even doctrine. Student teacher. The skill, I think, is sort of is the apprentice leader sort of relationship, and sometimes we use the word coach in there as well. I'm learning how to do this, and it's very practical sometimes. How do you do this? This one, I think, a lot of times I like to use the word mentors, you know, mentor discipleship here in this category, mentor mentoree. And I think mentor discipleship is a good phrase. A lot of us just will use the word discipleship, which is fine. But discipleship is wider. It's all discipling Jesus. So mentor helps nail it down to sort of that one-on-one, maybe a relational model. We're really getting into our stuff, you know, and going, what's going on? And what is the Holy Spirit doing in our lives? And how is he changing us? I don't know about you, but some churches mash all these three things together. One person sort of the mentor, and they all work on all three. Sometimes they'll separate this into categories. You could have a small group coach that's focusing. In Illinois, we'll have a small group coach that might be focusing more on the skill, but they might have a separate mentor that's focusing a little bit more on character. Do you see what I'm saying? And sometimes maybe the teaching or doctrine might just come from sort of the weekly meeting, or it might come from some other engagement group. But for all of us, as we're thinking, how are we growing as leaders, these three things, but then also how are we training leaders, these three things. So if you're a small group leader and you're trained in this area and you've been a receiver, awesome. And now as you start thinking about how are my people in my group doing, I start thinking about, gosh, what truth do they know in doctrine? How good are they at doing the skills of ministry? And then how are they growing in their character? I want to think in all three for balance. Let me do who do we pass it on to, and then I'll do what. This was what, who, and then how. What do you think the number one qualification is to be, say, like a small group leader? If you had to pick one, what do you think?
Humility.
Humility. Very good one.
Like being able to ask for help when you need it. Know what you're doing and need to rely on.
Awesome. What's your name?
Stephanie.
Good. Really good. Yeah. Anyone else?
Probably some experience.
Some experience?
Yeah.
Experience in...
Like experience, whether, you know, like Paul would say, Timothy, like, should be some convert. Probably mm-hmm. got some experience in your church.
Okay.
And how your church is run and, you know, someone you can see is clearly following the Lord and probably has been through some trials, so experience.
That's good. These are really good answers. You know, people will talk about all sorts of things. Gosh, they should be sort of a passionate person. They should sort of know Bible stuff. They should probably be really good at talking to people or engaging, maybe, you know, if we're sort of doing an outreach kind of small group. They should be a super compelling communicator, maybe. I don't know. I had this guy Tim come up to me after at University of Illinois at one point, and he was like this half philosophy major, half business major, so like annoyingly smart, and also really driven. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, I've been wanting to be a small group leader. How do I be a leader?" You know, and he's like, "What do you look?" And he's, you know, some business majors, have you noticed? Some business majors are like, "Woo, just along for the ride, doing something else and also doing business." But some business majors are like, "I was trying to go to Harvard when I was 14. Do you know what I'm saying? That's this guy. And this guy's like practically interviewing me at church, going, what should I do for the interview for small group leader?" And he's like, "Okay, what are you looking for in a small group leader? I want to be a small group leader." And I asked him this question: What do you think sort of the most important things for a small group leader should be? And he listed a bunch of things, but what he didn't say was really humility. And the way I would phrase it, and I think that's almost a perfect answer, and the way I would phrase it is teachability. Right? Because if I can teach someone something, everything else can come along. But if someone's not teachable, but they, this is a real common mistake for young leaders, guys. You start picking an apprentice and you pick someone that looks sort of sharp, seems to communicate real well, they might be outgoing, but if they're not teachable, it's going to go bad, I promise you, because they won't be able to take correction or coaching from you in anything. If someone is totally teachable, I'll take them on. You know, like, let's do it. I don't care if we're down here on skills, we'll get there. Down there on doctrine, we'll get there. Even down there on character. But the character, the teachable falls under the character, doesn't it? The humility. And I think that's the number one qualification, whether you're a leader or you're picking a new leader. What do you think?
I was thinking, you used to say look for fat people, faithful, available.
Or there's another variation, fatso. Faithful, available, teachable, saved, I guess because we threw that in there accidentally, and others-oriented, so, right. No, so it's really good. And then we just dropped the whole thing because it just felt really inappropriate to use that. So, but faithful, available, and teachable, absolutely. So good. How do we pass this on? So say, I want to get real practical here. Say I'm a leader and I have an apprentice. I'm an apprentice and a leader. How do we do this? And the way we talk about a lot, I want to focus a little bit on the skill mostly at this point. Say, how do I pass on how to lead a discussion in a group? Okay, and I like to do this course on discussion leading 101, but how do we lead a great discussion? You know, all of us have been in discussions at a small group that, boy, this discussion sucks. I really want to get out of here right now. I can't believe we're still sitting in our chairs. This is awful, you know. And then some discussions are really amazing and really intense, and we're sort of engaged. And a lot of it does have to do with the leadership, like how we pass on this skill of drawing people into a conversation that produces something that's good that the Spirit works in. So how do we pass on that skill? Well, I think we do it using these four levels we call the coaching levels: 1, 2, 3, and 4. I like to teach us to them, but I need two people. They're going to be volunteers, and you get a prize. One, two. Okay, come up. Here's your prize. Christmas gift for you.
Oh,
unwrap
God.
It. Christmas gift for you. And there you go. You want to unwrap that guy, because we're going to need to demonstrate. Well, they unwrap their toilet bowl cleaners. You're going to need it right now. You're going to demonstrate. If you can grab those and pass one of those around, you can grab and pass that direction. Yeah, no problem. We're going to need a toilet of some kind. Here we go. There's a throne right there. That's perfect. Little Christmas gift. You got yours ready? Okay. I think you're probably going to not need that thing on the end, but you know, hey. Hey, why don't we have both you guys up here, and we're going to demonstrate together how to do the coaching levels. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm giving you a handout, and you see at the top it says to teach a skill. You guys can look at one, too. Although, where's my extras here?
Thank you.
There you are. And it says the coaching levels, and it sort of says level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4. And level 1 is this idea. Oh, you see in each one, you see learning leader and you see coach. And there's roles for each person. So the apprentice, the person learning, and the person that's teaching the skill. You will be the coach.
Okay.
You will be the learning leader. Excellent. What's your name?
I'm Jimmy.
Jimmy. Hi, Jimmy. Well, level one is this I do you watch. So the learning leader says, hey, I'm going to demonstrate how to do this. Very good. And I'm going to demonstrate how to do this. Why don't you watch? And so say we're learning how to clean a toilet, for instance. And this is the analogy we use at Colorado LT a lot because a lot of people have to learn to clean toilets there. why don't you stand there and I'll show you how to do it right, because we don't want to leave, you know, flecks of any kind. that's probably as far as I should go with that. Okay. And so in this case, Hannah would sort of clean the toilet and you'd sit and watch, right? And you see, excellent job. Okay, you don't have to do that forever. And you see that the learning leader or the coach ensures that the apprentice is present. Is he there? Yes. Is he well positioned to observe? Move over here because you can't see. Yeah. And so she'd make sure that the coach performs the skill well, the best she cleans. Full swirl. Okay. And defines clearly for the apprentice what's being done so she can explain. She goes, okay, we're using the liquid, we're doing the thing. Little flushing and flushing twice. And then explains the rationale for the actions. Here's why you do this. If you don't do it like this, you might go off the rails here. This is what will happen. Then it answers questions. The learning leader, on the other hand, sort of spends time intentionally observing the leader. The whole goal is watching, seeing, right? Learns what things are to be done, seeks to understand why things are done. It's both the list of what and why, right? We need those. And then asks questions before and after and during the task. So all through it. Good job. Level two, we do together. This is the thing where you and your apprentice sort of work on doing a skill together. So clearly at this point we're both cleaning a toilet. The learning leader shifts from observation to participation. Okay, so Jimmy's participating, does a portion of the skill with the leader, and this works perfectly with toilets as we can see. Does not need to be proficient or experienced, no need for that. Just needs to sort of be participating. But receives feedback from the leader. So Hannah's like, oh, missed a spot, you know. Right? And Hannah's doing the opposite of that. She's working together with the apprentice to complete the task. She retains full responsibility for the results in level two. We do together. So if there's, you know, here comes along Chris and I'm in charge of toilet cleaning, and I go, huh, how'd you do? Here, you know, I don't think we do this with the white glove on the toilet, but maybe you do. It's Hannah's responsibility if there's a problem. You see that? The apprentice doesn't have any responsibility on them at that point. The coach still makes decisions as they occur. We need to do two toilets at once. This is how we're going to time it. And gives feedback for the apprentice while you're doing it and helps correct mistakes. Whoops, you sort of messed that up. Well, level three is the you do, I watch, right? And so now it's Jimmy's time to sort of get in on the toilet action, and Hannah's going to step back and sort of not do it, but she's going to keep her eyes on it. So the learning leader takes the lead in completing the task, understands what and why things are done, makes decisions on choices as they occur. Whoa, this is an emergency toilet. What do I do? This one might involve a plunger of some kind. This is Jimmy's responsibility if it's level three. This is Jimmy's responsibility to know what to do. Hannah walks into the emergency toilet, but they've already talked about it on level two somewhere. And so she waits to see what Jimmy's going to do. Has a basic level of experience, may receive suggestions from the coach during the task, but can choose what to do with it. So Hannah could give a suggestion, hey, what if you... But she's not telling him what to do. And Jimmy should, at level three, the apprentice should be able to make a choice on that decision and feel the freedom from the leader to choose whether or not to use that feedback or not. Mm-hmm. It gives more and more freedom. You're sort of letting out the leash a little bit. And it must be okay with some failure and mistakes. And this is the key to level three, of we should allow mistakes. And so from Hannah's perspective, it says on the bottom, generally does not step in to correct mistakes at level three. Mm-hmm. She sees something going wrong, she goes, oh. and holds her tongue for a little bit. They're going to talk about it. But a lot of times she needs Jimmy to make that mistake and see what the outcome of that mistake is, right? Louise is not going to learn if she jumps in all the time. He's not going to see that. She gives detailed feedback after a task, not during. The after and during are real important. At level three is after. Level two is during. And so you guys could sit down and have a toilet debriefing afterwards and go, hey, let's talk about how that went. And then you can get as much detail as you want. You can say, gosh, wow, lists of things. And then go on and talk about it as you've agreed. But you do it after you've done it. In this case, in level 3, usually it's actually still Hannah's final responsibility for the results. So even though Jimmy's doing almost all the work, at the end of the day, she's finally responsible for did the toilet get cleaned. Okay? Level 4 is you do. So at this point, Jimmy becomes the toilet master. And Hannah sits down and goes away and she says, call me if you need me. And Jimmy's the one that cleans, becomes the leader, accepts final responsibility for the results, so the responsibility shifts to you, and you eventually learn to pray on your own apprentice. Right? Nice job, guys. Please give them a little hand for their... Yeah.
Jimmy and I spent a summer together cleaning toilets.
For real?
Yeah.
Wow, that's why you were so good.
She was my coach.
What's that? No, they're for you. Sorry, you have to have them now. I put them in my suitcase in the plane. They're not going back in there. They're special gifts. Look, a gift horse in the mouth. No, it's good. You guys follow that situation pretty well? Do you see why very small distinctions matter a great deal? One of them is like, when do we give feedback? Where in the situation? So I have an apprentice sitting in a small group, and I'm at level 2. How do I do a level 2 small group together? Well, gosh, what does your small group do? Maybe it does an opening time, then maybe it has a discussion, maybe it has a prayer time, maybe you have a pattern you use, maybe that pattern changes. We need to figure out how we're going to do that together. Now, you can't both talk at once, and the leader in the group needs to know who to look at to lead. But you guys hand off things. Okay, as the apprentice, how about you do prayer requests this week, and I'll do the discussion leading, and then we'll swap next time. And both people are there, and you hand it off verbally. When you get really good at small group leading in this context, you can hand off stuff. Two experienced leaders, I led a small group with Allison Smith, one of our other coaches, for a good while on our campus. And we had both been leading for years. We were starting a new group in a new dorm, and so we had two staff sort of do it. And her and I, we didn't plan the group a lot. We walked in and said, Allison, what are we doing today? She goes, I don't know, Chris, why don't we start with prayer? I was like, good idea, Allison. And we just sort of talk it out live in the group, and we were able to do that. And this is a skill that's helpful for level 2, because you can talk back and forth with your apprentice. Say, hey, what do you think about doing this? And let you draw in and let everyone sort of see your apprentice as you do it. Level 3 at this point, when your apprentice says, hey, I know, let's do an icebreaker. There's only 27 of us, so let's each take 10 minutes to share a short story. In your mind, because you're a smart group leader, you go, that's going to be 5,500 hours. That's an impossible icebreaker. We shouldn't be doing that right now. We can see the train running off the cliffs, starting with person 1. But if you're at level 3 or level 3.5, sometimes people slip a level 3.5 in on this. You can't stop it. If you're someone that's training someone else to be a leader at that point, and you guys have already made it through level 2 okay, and you guys have done stuff together, and they've understood what and why it's done it, you should not step into that, which means you might have a small group sort of suck that week. Because you might get like halfway through it and realize it's already been an hour for the group, and we haven't, and that's taken over the group, and now we're punting the discussion, and now we're not doing the other things that we thought we were going to do, and the plan is not what we thought because of not a good leadership decision. But that leader that's learning needs to sort of feel what it has to mess up a small group. And so you got to sort of hands off, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Now, if they look to you for rescue and you're the leader, great, that's okay. Go, oh no, what am I going to do? You could give some suggestions to them, but they get to decide what to do. Hey, why don't we do this half of the room? You know, if someone looked to me like this, if Justin was doing this, I was like, oh my gosh, Justin, what are you doing? And then at some point he goes, I just realized I'm making a mistake, and he looks to me and goes, hey, what should I do? I don't tell the group what to do. I talk to him. Right there in the group. He goes, oh, I don't know what we should do. We're going to go way over time. And instead of me taking over the group or leading, I talk to him. And I go, I don't know, man. What if we stopped now with the icebreaker and we let the rest of the other half of the group do the same icebreaker next week and we just continue with something else? What do you think about that? Justin's decision whether or not to do that because they were at level 3. You following that? That's a big deal. If I stepped in and took over the group right there when he looked for help, then I'm communicating that he's not valuable as a leader to the whole group and it doesn't give him the experience to grow. Are these things helpful, what we're doing in terms of the different levels? That's a lot of what I want to communicate to you. I mean, I have other tips and we can talk about all sorts of things. Is this relating to your situation? And, well, let me make my last point, but then bring up something else if you want to bring it up. This system of training someone how to do something gets back into the idea of the four questions I asked. Do you know how to apprentice a group? Do you know how to lead a group? Do you know how to teach someone else to lead a group, which is a different skill than leading? And do you know how to teach someone to teach someone to lead a group? Because that's true multiplication. Am I teaching in a way that they will be able to teach in the future? And this kind of framework, when you do it with them, they're learning not only how to do the skill, whether leading a group or doing something else, but also they're learning a method for training someone. And learning the method is what allows them to reproduce their life, not just learning to do it. And so the method is what actually allows us to multiply our lives when we teach how to do things. So that this is why I say a model for multiplying leadership. This is real key. Are we teaching a model, not just how to do the thing? I'm curious how this relates to your situation, and we probably have time for one or two people to bring up a question or some case studies, and we could talk it out some.
In your experience, are these leadership levels known between you and your apprentice, or is it kind of spoken?
So really good question. You're asking, hey, does the apprentice and the leader know these levels, or is it some like it's on a secret video camera somewhere or something? No, you got to know these levels. And so, yeah, it's known. And so what I should have said is I think anyone that picks up an apprentice, if you're a leader, and say, hey, would you be my apprentice? We sit down, and literally, if you're a project leader at Colorado LT, when I'm out there, I actually ask the apprentice and leader to sit down with this document. You don't have to do it like this. They sit down and read through this if they weren't familiar with it. Then they discuss together where they're going to start at. Some people are going to start at level one. Some people, if they come into LT, but they've had a lot of small group leader experience, so maybe they want to start at level two or level three with their coach. That could be appropriate. But I want them to discuss it. Most of our issues that we have in leadership training have to do with missed expectations. So either the coach is stepping in too little, gosh, you're just leaving me out here in the cold. You're not helping me at all. What am I supposed to do? Or they're stepping in way too much. The blanket's really hot here, you know, I need some space, I need to learn to lead on my own, you keep on stepping in, you know. And that's often because of missed expectations, though you haven't talked out. So like, hey, let's start at level two. When the apprentice and the leader has that expectation, they know we're going to work together, and they're going to be able to correct mistakes live. Then I actually, when I apprentice somebody, we talk about moving, sort of moving the level. It's not a rank, really, it's just moving through the process. And so, hey, it seems like we should be doing level three next week. What do you think, if you really just take it? Yeah, I feel comfortable with that. I don't know, that makes me a little nervous. Okay, we'll do level two for another week. That's fine. So we literally talk that out. So I want every leader, especially, to know what level they're at. I'll ask my leaders, what levels are your apprentices at? Is that what you're thinking? Yeah.
I'm wondering, what do you look for as transition markers as it's appropriate to move from this level to the next? How do I know in a transition, what am I looking for to say, this is really time for level three, or maybe we need a little more at level two?
Yeah.
And then also, how much time do you spend at each?
Okay, good.
On average.
Well, let's go with how much time you spend on each first, because that's dramatically about what the task is and who the people are and stuff, right? So there's not a time thing. There's not like 1 month, 1 month, 1 month, 1 month. If you had any church that set that up, that'd be a bad system, because some people are going to move a whole lot slower than others. Some people are going to, you know, sometimes the skills are different. This works, by the way, for not just, I've been saying small group leadership a lot. We did small group leadership on toilets so far. But this works for worship bands. This works for like all sorts of kind of things. It works really on a job too, you know. But so the time is completely based on the comfort and the training.
I guess I meant relative time in particular. I don't know if that was
relative time, like level one, yeah.
Like, let's spend twice as much at level three as level one, because there's so much important learning that happens there.
Yeah, I think that's good. Generally, I would say the curve for small group leadership, well, just to be honest, there's some learning styles in here too, but probably if I have one parts and two parts, one part level one, two parts level two, two parts level three, and one part level four. I say that as a guy, and I know my weaknesses. I am really good at level one. I'm really good at level four as a leader. I'm actually particularly bad at people in the level two thing. I tend to throw people in too fast. This is a mistake and some leaders can make, and you start to learn your personality and where you don't do well. I am not a good step-by-step guy. I'm a good, vary in the details, let's talk about what and why, or I'm a good systems guy. This is why I'm teaching this system, okay? But I'm not very good at level two, and I've had leaders come back to me. I had one woman who was trained to be our service manager, and I was a service director for a while, and she was just killer good. She was just so good. And an engineer, and she was like won awards in women in engineering in our campus, and she was just taking over stuff. And I had a lot of confidence in her, and I'll have overconfidence in people and so assume they want to move forward to level four faster. And I just said, great, you got it. You're doing so she just killed it on level one. She was like fast questions. I'm an engineer, right? You know, she's just like, why do you do that? Oh, I got it. Okay, you know, perfect system, figured out this thing. So she's getting it so fast. I'm like, oh, we don't need to do a whole lot together. You know, you can just move on. You take it over, call me if you have questions. And I actually heard her. We did the end of the semester and we sat down and I said, I ask all the time, how'd I do this semester with helping you grow? And she goes, it was actually sort of hard. You really didn't do much with me. It's like, oh, dang. So we didn't, on the transition from the stage to stage, what I failed to do in there was ask her. Hey, does this make sense for us to move on to the next stage? I think most of the time our apprentices get it right on when they think it's appropriate to move up. Sometimes we get overconfident, cocky person, and they think, I'm level four right now. And you're like, no, you ain't. You know. But most of the time, the communication allows us to know when to move to the next level. We just talk about it. I don't know if that's a good enough answer for you, but...
Nothing else.
Did you have thoughts on his first question, though, like when you transition from
life age? Well, the talking about it, when you guys decide together, I think is a good transition marker. The other thing you can look at is doctrine, skills, and character, and go, what items in these are important to this role? Mm-hmm. And do we have certain things that matters? But those better be very clearly communicated. You know, so if I have in my mind, gosh, I'm really thinking that they need more scriptural knowledge to lead this small group, but I haven't really, but they don't know that, I have failed as a teaching leader. They should know precisely what they need to do to sort of move to the next level. So if they're saying, oh gosh, I think I'm ready, and you're like, I don't know, and you're sort of trying to hold back, but they don't know why and what would move them to the next level, I'm messing it up.
Yeah.
I don't know if that, yeah. Yeah.
How long should someone be?
That's, so how long should someone be at level four before they pick? Yeah, that's a real good question. Gosh, situation dependent too. Level four is this sort of indeterminate stage. We arrived and then it could be sort of forever or, you know, I mean, a lot of your campus pastors are at level four with Greg Veneta and they have been for 10 years, you know, and are they training other people? Yes, but they actually still are sort of at level four with Greg Veneta in terms of he's a resource for them to call when they get into situations as leaders that we don't know what to do. I still run into situations like, well, this is a new one, you know, and so who do I have that I can call? So sort of level four can be sort of this always and forever idea. But you sounds like you're saying is how long before someone picks the next leader? You know, gosh, you know, if we're going to put months on it, probably not so good to put a timeline on it. But wouldn't it be nice if they're in that for... You know, if as a small group leader, a lot of times I think 6 months to a year is sort of minimum before they're going to pick up a new apprentice. If we have to multiply that group faster, a lot of times we'll put a leader in that group and then I'll put a coach in that group that's not the coach of that person. That's a coach of a different apprentice that we're moving up at a different stage and so we're layering. If we need to get into hyper splitting groups. I don't know if that means. So I don't let the new leader pick up an apprentice right away. But we really need to split the group again. I put a senior coach in that group, and they take a different apprentice within the same group. And then when groups are big, like a small group, if you have a 25-person small group, a lot of times it's good to split down a lot during the group, you know, for different portions of that group time. And so the other apprentice might be taking one half of the group while the formal leader is taking the other half, and so I'm getting some stuff done that way. I don't know if that... Yes, sir.
So to be clear, is it kind of like when they start doing most things with a small group efficiently, like you can run a small group by yourself for the most part, there's going to be some oddities and some questions. Like when they get to that point, is that like a good time to say, maybe you should start teaching somebody to go through as well?
Absolutely. Find an apprentice. Time next stage is like, hey man, you're doing so good. Love what you're doing. Time to find someone else that can start learning from you. And that's a conversation. We sit down and go, hey, do you want to be an apprentice with me with this group? It's none of this, I sort of think they're an apprentice, but we've never really talked about it, but they sort of are. What? It doesn't work. It happens. People say, well, this person's sort of learning what's going on. Great, but make it a thing. Let's talk about it. When we get engaged, we decide, hey, let's talk about getting engaged. That'd be good instead of just assuming it might be running up a marriage. You know, like, and there's a level of, the reason I say that is because there's a level of covenant or commitment when we train. So let's sort of say, you know, let's say we're doing this, right? You want to do it? Great.
Yeah. Do they necessarily have to be level 4 leaders in order to, I guess, take on somebody else that they're, like, discipling or building into?
Building into, we might sort of, this might get into the doctrine skill character. You could have someone building into sort of even a character and a mentoring and just walking with God kind of thing, I think. So we're sort of been living in this skill area in terms of leadership. I think in that area, yeah, it is probably important to have people at level 4.
Like a level, let's say you're a 4 and you're building it, I mean, obviously you're a 4, you're building into someone who might be at 2 or 3, and then maybe you encourage them to, because I think college just kind of works out where you kind of got upperclassmen, let's say the seniors, and then you've got like, you know, sophomores and juniors who you're kind of building into. Then you got freshmen too. So
right.
In a way, I mean, kind of situation where you might have somebody who may be in level 3 cleaning toilets, but you're kind of like, hey, why don't you bring someone else along with you?
Yep.
And just kind of do that together. I mean, I guess that depends on the task.
Absolutely, because scope of the task is where we build leaders, right? So when we build freshmen, like Mizzou does this freshman leadership thing. When we talk about building younger leaders, let's give them a task that move all the way through levels 1 through 4 in a very small scope. So if it goes completely off the rails, not a whole lot's messed up. So, you know, gosh, would you lead a cooking team of 3 people for your home group? Or can they lead one of the tech teams that's a sub-tech team of a roll-in thing, you know, that's not, you know, but could they be the leader of 2 or 3 other people? The military does this, right? You have squads and then platoons and then companies and this kind of stuff. Let's build that leader. And when I was assistant patrol leader in Boy Scouts, which was very prestigious. let's move all the way through level 1 through 4. If they're 18 and they walk in and they're like, this person seems sort of sharp. They're someone to train as a leader. I'm not making them the home group leader, but I want to give them full ownership of something small as fast as I can. And so they get involved. And so move 1 through 3, 4. I can move them all through in one semester. Their second semester, their freshman year, they're owning a small thing. Does that connect with what you're...
So it's like the 1, 2, 3, 4, they're almost just certain steps of leadership. You almost continually...
I move through 1, 2, 3, 4 all the time.
Yeah.
Heather Dole is the one that runs our training events at the GCM office, and she manages all the like the things if you come to training and learn to raise support and that kind of stuff. And there's things I don't know on how we do our event system. She technically works for me, but I go, hey, Heather, train me on how to do this. She starts me at level 1. Perfect. You know, she goes, okay, let me watch me while I do this. You know, that's how I learn. Yeah. So we use that all the time. Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't think we get any more questions, man. You're my last one. And then we're done.
So I was thinking about taking on a guy, and he's performance oriented. You know what I mean by that? So let's say I'm really going to see this as like a task that he has to complete to get to the different steps. What are ways that like you would say I would encourage him or like speak life into him to let him focus on the level he's on and not the one after it? Does that make sense?
So you're saying you have this guy, he's performance oriented, which means that he's from Michigan.
<it's> like,
but that you worry that he would do what?
He would view it as more as a task that's complete to get to the next level instead of kind of like settling in at the level he's at. Like, what are ways that I could just encourage?
You worry that he'd overreach and try to move past where you're actually at? Is that right?
Ongoing, just like, what do I have to do to get to the next step? Next step, next step.
Sure, right. It sounds like his character is going to be involved in the skill a great deal. Right, because this is a skill thing, but you're even talking to character. What if he overpresses and he's not patient or doesn't have, you know, not? But if he's pressing against what do I need to do, that could be really good. That's someone that's this idea of someone that's trying to pursue a great. Have you ever heard of aggressive teachability? You know, this idea of I'm aggressively being teachable. What do I need to do next? Tell me what to do. That's really cool sometimes, you know. But it sounds like you're sort of picturing this other situation where it wouldn't be a teachability. It would be, let me check the box to get out of here. And then you sometimes wind up saying, hey, faithfulness-wise, integrity-wise, humility-wise, maybe we need to stay at this other level. But this is a model really well for skill, and I think this doesn't work quite as well for character. That'd be a whole other thing. But, yeah. Guys, we blasted through an hour real fast. Thank you so much for coming, and we're done.